Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Erin Stare, and this is the Trial Site News podcast. And I'm here with Dr. Robert Malone, who became a celebrity overnight, literally. So you're famous now. How does that feel?
A little weird. I've never sought out media attention. Matter of fact, I usually try to stay below the radar.
Can I tell the story of how I met you?
Yeah, please do.
So I have a smaller podcast called Causes or Cures, and I was reading about antibody dependent enhancement, which a lot of people were saying, this is going to kill us all with these vaccines. And I'm like, okay, this sounds like hyperbole. Let's get someone on my podcast who knows what they're talking about. And I reached out to so many different people, and they had to ask permission from their academic institutions, and they all declined. And then one person referred me to Dr. Malone, and I sent him an email, and then I think he wrote back, asking a vaccinologist to talk about this is asking them to commit professional suicide or something like that. It was funny. And I just wrote back, well, okay, are you okay with that? And then he did the podcast. But it turned out to be an amazing podcast because you explain stuff so well. And all my friends, most of my friends who listen to that podcast, they don't have scientific backgrounds. And they were like, I understood that, Erin. I was like, well, there we go.
So, cool.
But yeah, you're famous now. So how does that feel?
It feels really hectic. I'm not getting any of my day job done. But I'll tell you, Erin, what's happened is, the combination of this cascade of events and my own CV and my role in the initial discovery of the RNA delivery and vaccines and stuff gives me legitimacy that I guess largely is protecting me from being censored by the usual social media channels. And so I'm saying things, I'm able to say things. I'm really careful what I say. I try to be careful. And so they don't have a good excuse to whack me. And it's brought people all over the globe out of the woodwork. I feel like I'm channeling the collective angst of a global network of frustrated scientists and physicians. And by the way, I'm inundated with calls, random calls. I mean, I can hardly have dinner from patients that just need to be listened to, or patients' parents, or patients' spouses, or patients' brothers, or whatever. And there's this groundswell of angst, and it's channeling to me. And I feel like I have a responsibility to them as a physician to kind of give voice to a lot of this stuff. And then there another thing that happened with Trial Site that was crucial was I had so Trial Site is an interesting vehicle because it's very rapid and relatively unfiltered. I don't have to go through peer review. And so I was on a phone call with a Canadian physician that went from 10 to midnight. And the gentleman is just pouring his heart out to me about his patients and how every time he files something that's an adverse event, it just gets immediately dismissed without any investigation. And he's telling me about what's happening in Canada from the government. And I'm listening to this, and I just keep having to say to him, there's nothing I can do for you. And I wake up in the morning and I'm like, aha, I know what I can do. And I built this logic structure around bioethics. And it was the bioethics of experimental vaccination for COVID. And it was published on Trial Site News, and the red pill metaphor from The Matrix keeps getting overused. But this thing is like a red pill. People that are in denial read it, or you walk them through the logic, and it just opens up their mind that it's not okay what's going on. The censorship isn't okay. The gaslighting of people who have symptoms, the censorship on social media, these things. Just to give one example, there was a Facebook group of kind of a contact group of people that were sharing stories about adverse events associated with vaccination. It was about 200, 250 people strong. And it just got deleted. And if you're one of those people, if you kind of put yourself in their position for a moment, all around them, they're getting the message that you're crazy. You couldn't possibly be having vaccine-related adverse events because they don't happen. And so you participate in this shared experience with other people on social media, and then you get deleted. It's flat out depressing for these people.
Yeah, so I agree. And I think people just want to be heard. And it's difficult too, because you're dealing with a complex media landscape here, and different things might be expressed online. You know, there is misinformation, right? There is that. And then, like I said, you might have saw my tweet. I said there are people who try to latch on to like scientific dissent or scientific concerns from legitimate, rooted in science, to kind of bolster their own position. And there's people who disinform, like who have more like nefarious motives. But the problem is that it's all getting looped together, right? There's no such thing as scientific dissent or questioning. It's all misinformation, which is not right. That's incorrect. It's inaccurate. And it's very frustrating. I mean,
and overlaid on this, so this is one of these things that came to me from other docs, is the Trusted News Initiative. So Trusted News Initiative is not a crazy figment of somebody's imagination. You can look it up. And it's a consortium. You can Google Trusted News Initiative and BBC and vaccines. And you're going to find BBC proudly announcing that they're taking the Trusted News Initiative consortium, which includes Facebook and Associated Press and all the usual actors, and was designed to combat misinformation in times of crisis and political change. And as of last December, they decided that vaccine disinformation was one of those things. And they were going to clamp down on it. And it feels to many of us like it's coordinated censorship. And in fact, it is. It's not crazy talk.
I have to laugh sometimes when I read people who fact check you. I laugh because they'll be like, there's some guy in a video. And I was like, oh my gosh, they didn't even say who he was, who's the original inventor of mRNA technology. But I have to laugh when they're like fact checking you. They're like, some guy sitting in a chair on this podcast is saying something weird about the spike protein. And nobody knows, like nobody, but none of the fact checkers bothered to check out who you were.
So like you, I've been swimming in this social media environment for a couple of decades. For me, I mean, it goes back to me interacting on Yahoo stock chat boards at least 20 years ago. So I'm kind of, like I say, I put on my big boy pants in the morning, and I'm fairly immune to most of this stuff. I mean, there's always haters, and you know, you just delete them, or you don't answer them, or you know, and you don't talk to the crazies and stuff like that. But yeah, it is so. You know, when I get fact-checked by PolitiFact and Reuters, and they get it wrong, I do have a certain sense of being threatened, but I try really hard to be well-grounded in the data and to speak from the data and from the science. I don't always get it right, but when I get it wrong and somebody points it out, I immediately say, yeah, you're right, I'm wrong.
And you know why they pointed it out? Because it's so rare. It's so rare to see somebody do that. They're like, did you see this guy? He said he was wrong about this. And it's like, it goes viral. Isn't that sad?
This is weird times. And there's so, it's not just disinformation coming from social media. The truth is that we're inundated with disinformation from our public health agencies globally. And I'm sure it's all with the best intent. But you know, Dr. Fauci was quite clear in the FOIA emails that he has been comfortable substituting his own opinion for facts because he thought he was saying things that would be helpful. But that's not okay, and it's compromising people's faith in the public health system and a lot of other things. And as you may recall, early on in this outbreak, I made a bunch of statements on LinkedIn that we better make sure, if we're going to rush these vaccines, that we get it right. And if we didn't get it right, we're going to play right into the storyline, the memes of the anti-vaccine crowd. And lo and behold, here we are.
And I think too, it's a dilemma. It's a dilemma. Like, I think there should be more focus on early treatment, right? But like, I think there's not going to be a perfect solution in this. And I think we also have to remember that. And like you said, like, people working at these organizations, they're not like, we tend to dehumanize them and that kind of thing, but they're just people. They're people trying to do their best, and they're not making, most of the people are not making tons of money and that kind of thing. And I think people have to remember that too.
I agree.
Yeah. And it's just people trying to do their job.
They're receiving all the same messaging the rest of us are,
right?
That these vaccines are perfectly safe. And so, you know, for them to go against that and to be wary or alert that maybe there are adverse events, you know, they're risking their relationship with their supervisors. You guys all work in office environments. You know how this works.
To go back to your point, I've been seeing, like, you know, there's so many different sources of media out there now. And one thing I do is I follow like blatant misinformation. And I've seen you've pulled into some of these memes. They list your name. And I have to laugh because I'm like, this guy is not an anti-vaxxer. In fact, you like eat, drink, sleep vaccines. That's what you do. Right? So like, that's why it's so funny to me, because if they knew like all the vaccines that you kind of had, you played a hand in bringing to fruition, it's so ironic. Like, and it is, it's just a weird time.
It is.
Yeah.
And I get beaten up all the time. And I've just come hot off of a meeting with these three insider FDA buddies that I occasionally refer to in these various podcasts. And I felt the need to check in with them and say, okay, guys, you know that I've said these things. Are we all okay? Am I still on message? You know, am I missing something? So I just felt the need to check in with them. And one of them was quite agitated because I found myself on Tucker Carlson last night. And his comment was, Tucker is, you know, his mission is to take down the administration. And he didn't have any specific, he was completely aligned with what I said. Matter of fact, I was basically serving as a mouthpiece for a lot of their angst in what I said. But he just was adamant that I shouldn't be interacting with conservative media. But right now, conservative media are the ones that are open. You and I both, you know, do this where we work with the government and do other things, and we must remain agnostic, apolitical.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can't be aligned with this administration or that administration, because they'll change. Yeah. And that's the nature of working with the federal government, is check your politics at the door.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just speak your truth and you know, you're coming with good intentions, and you want people to informed consent. And I know you're trained in bioethics, and that, you know, kind of guides everything you do and say. So I respect that. And I thought you did a good job on Tucker.
Thank you. Yeah. It's a little weird.
Yeah. Was there like a bright light shining on you?
Yeah, they sent, so this is the reality of it. It's a little bizarre. So I live in a horse farm. It's about 50 acres in Virginia between Charlottesville and Dulles Airport. And so they decided that, in their wisdom, that it was too far for me to drive into DC to get their studio. And so they were going to send a van down. And so this van shows up, and it's all black inside. And they park and they get the connections with the cell tower, just like I use here. And I go and sit in the chair, and they've got a TV monitor behind me, and they decide they're going to make it look like I've got a city backdrop. There's all this rush, trying to make all the connections work and everything. And then suddenly you're on, and I didn't even get to see Tucker. You know, there's a slight delay in the signal, and I'm looking at myself. They got these bright lights all on me that are all pre-arranged in the van. It's super lighting. I look fairly good. There was no makeup, and I'm on for barely 3 minutes, and then it's done. I'm out the door, and off he goes to Falls Church for the next appointment. It's just a little bit surreal.
Okay, spike protein. Let's start with the natural spike protein on the virus. What do we know that it does and doesn't do?
So this question of the activity of the spike really developed after well into the outbreak. And it was coupled with people asking what was the activity of the virus itself using cell culture, animal models, organoids. Organoids is kind of a new term for a lot of us. These are our human-like organs that are grown in a test tube using stem cell technology. And they've been developed basically to enable alternatives to animal models and ability to capture data from human tissues without having to do human experiments. So a series of experiments were done after they initiated the development of the vaccines that asked questions about the toxicity of the virus, how it would interact with brain cells, blood-brain barrier, vascular endothelium, cells in general, et cetera. And then as that science developed, people started asking, well, how much of these things that we are seeing are due to this part of the virus or that part of the virus? And one of the things they focused on was this knob of three things that kind of sticks out that we call spike. It's not like you would see on the collar of a fighting dog or something like that. It's not a bunch of sharp things that come out. It's a bunch of little knobs of protein that are what the virus uses to stick to the cells that it wants to infect. And it also has this characteristic that it changes its shape as it infects, like a lot of the virus receptors do. A lot of the receptor ligand interactions, the virus first binds in an open conformation to its target, and then it undergoes a change in shape that helps trigger the ability of the virus to enter the cell. Spike does this. And so there was data started emerging really last fall with human organoids and with mouse models and then with other tissue models and some whole animal studies, including a nice one from the Salk Institute, my alma mater. That in fact, despite what Reuters says, yes, spike is cytotoxic. And spike also opens the blood-brain barrier in animal models and in human organoids. And then there's this whole group of things around symptoms, human symptoms, after infection and development of this disease that we call COVID. And the long-term COVID that we call long COVID. And some of the side effects that people have reported with the adenovirus-based genetic vaccines first. So here in the States, we call it the J&J product. And we found out that the J&J product was causing blood clotting. Blood clotting is a major problem with the disease. It's one of the core problems. And the vaccine was also causing blood clotting. That's kind of odd. Now we're seeing that the RNA vaccines, a different genetic vaccine technology that also expresses the spike protein, is triggering some of those same symptoms in some small subset of people. And in some small subset of people, they also have clotting problems, including these brain clots, which are worrisome, but that's very rare. And I don't want to alert the audience or scare you. I have no interest in spooking everybody and making a big kerfuffle. Some people enjoy that. I don't. These vaccines work. They're saving lives. But in some people, they're having these adverse events And the odd thing is that those adverse events seem to overlap with some of the symptoms of the disease that's caused by the whole virus. And they seem to overlap between the two different genetic technologies that are used for the vaccines. And so, and they overlap with some of the things that we know that spike can do by itself. And so this is one of those, I'm sorry, I'm going to say it, it looks like a duck, it walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, might be a duck. And it might be that these known toxicities associated with the wild type spike protein might be also associated with the engineered spike protein that is used as the antigen in these vaccines. And right now, we don't know that's the case for sure, but it kind of looks like it might be.
So the spike protein, and this is from the Salk paper that you, I don't know how I got it. I probably maybe got it from you, but I read it and they make it very clear in there. They're like, this is very different. This natural spike protein is very different than the one used in the vaccines, meaning something was done in that DNA or messenger RNA, that genetic material, to make spike protein do something a little different than the natural one. Is that right?
It is. So two things were done, and it varies with each vaccine. So you're exactly right. And that's one of the criticisms of me in saying that spike is cytotoxic, that you know, when I've been fact checked. But the one of the lovely things about interacting on social media is that everybody says their opinion, and it's a great place to kind of learn about what the criticisms of the alternative thinking might be, which is what science needs to be. So for me, it's really useful. And one of the criticisms is that the spike protein in the vaccines has been engineered. That's true. Some people assert that it was engineered to be more safe. That I have a little problem with, because the engineering was done before we knew that it was a risk. So that's kind of sounds like the cart before the horse.
Why was it done if they didn't know it was a risk?
Good question. That's the circular logic that I'm talking about, the cart before the horse. The one of the engineering things that was done was to I mentioned to you that spike undergoes a conformational change. That's fancy science talk for it moves from one structure to another structure as it binds and starts to enter into the cell. And the part that's changing its structure involves what's called the receptor binding domain. Now, what is that? What do those words mean? Spike interacts with a specific cellular receptor called ACE2. And it's present on things like vascular endothelial cells. These are the cells that line your blood vessels. Okay. So spike binds ACE2, and that is used to help cells get infected. That's how it gets in. And it binds initially in an open conformation where the receptor binding domain is wide open. Makes sense. Okay. And then it undergoes this change. And appropriately, and this has been a strategy that the Vaccine Research Center at NIH has used with other antigens. This isn't their first rodeo with a respiratory virus. They're the ones that engineered the Moderna product, just to clarify. And so it's a known strategy to engineer these virus receptor proteins, surface glycoproteins, and spike is heavily coated with sugars, by the way. But this area where it binds to ACE2 is open. It's not covered with sugars because it's got to bind to ACE2. So it's an open channel. And if you, the perfect antibody to knock out the ability of the virus to infect is an antibody that binds the receptor binding domain. So you want to make sure that that receptor binding domain is open so that it can be presented to B cells and provoke the right kind of antibodies. And that's why they do it. Okay. Is they want to lock it into an open conformation so it's a good antigen. Makes sense. In addition, They wanted this engineered spike that they've now made so that it stays open, so it's a better antigen. They wanted it to stay put in the cell that was expressing it. And so they put a transmembrane tag on it so that it'd get stuck into the membrane of the cell and it'd stay there. It wouldn't go floating around. So those are the two main things that, for instance, constitute the modifications in the Moderna product. So if I address that, why did they do it? They did it to make it a better antigen.
Yeah.
And to make it so it stayed put.
Were tests done like, hey, okay, yeah, well, this works. It stays put. Good job, guys.
Yes. So the initial, what she's asking about is how well was this characterized? Did it behave the way it was supposed to behave? And by the way, the other job that had to be done in a normal situation, I just want to kind of digress a little bit. When you're developing a new product, the rules are kind of French rules. If you imagine the French judicial system, you're guilty until proved innocent. In the US, it's different, right? You're innocent until proved guilty. For pharmaceutical product development, you're kind of assumed to be toxic unless you prove you're not. And it's the job of the pharmaceutical company interacting with the FDA to prove that this kind of a modification is safe and to prove that everything in the system behaves the way it's supposed to behave, the way that you claim that it's behaved. So the FDA is really typically pretty persnickety. If you say that the spike is going to stay put, they want you to show that it stays put. And if you say that it's safe, they want you to prove that it's safe. It would appear, based on the let me put it this way, it was a bit alarming to some of us when this study came out from Harvard and Brigham's of nurses that had received Moderna vaccine that showed with a very sensitive assay that they had free spikes circulating in their blood, because that wasn't supposed to happen, according to what was published before. And that free spike is circulating for like 14 to almost up to a month at detectable levels. And again, that should have been known before it ever went into humans based on animal model studies. It's not that hard to figure out. But for some reason, it wasn't.
So that study, it's like 23% of the, there was only 13 people in that study, right? Okay, so right. It's a small sample size, but it's like, it's a proof of something. Like it's, but I think only 23%, but here's my, had spike protein. It was after, and it used the mRNA vaccines, right?
This is Moderna. So Moderna. It's the highest dose.
Okay.
The highest dose of the mRNA vaccines.
Okay, but, and I might be remembering this incorrectly, so you can jump in if I am. They found the spike protein after the first dose. Is that correct? And after the second dose, they didn't. But when you're seeing these adverse effects, and they are pretty rare, aren't we seeing most of that after the second dose?
The second dose. But remember, the reason they're not seeing the free protein after the second dose
antibodies.
Is because you've already got antibodies against it.
Right.
And that raises a key thing about this, is that what they were detecting with this super sensitive assay is the free spike, which is in equilibrium with ACE2 bound spike, which is in equilibrium. These are biochemical terms. It means that it's going from this, it's balancing between one form and another form. So there's free spike in the blood, there's spike that's bound to ACE2, and their spike that hasn't yet been cut off the surface of the cell. So what they're measuring is really the tip of the iceberg. And no surprise that after dose number two, when you get a lot more antibodies, well, that free spike is getting sucked up by those antibodies. But it doesn't mean that it's not there.
I mean, and they probably should do larger studies on that, I guess, with more people, right?
I guess, but it's pretty definitive. I mean, you administer the vaccine. This is essentially a challenge study. It's not subtle. And we're not looking for some random statistical effect. We're measuring something directly. So I find it fairly compelling. And yeah, it would be a good idea, like all science, to have two or three other universities or laboratories. Or the truth is, this should have been known at phase one. That should have been the kind of thing that, in this case, Moderna should have done with their phase one or 2A studies. But for some reason, they didn't. Now, that's another thing that kind of doesn't seem right.
So let's talk about the, there was a Freedom of Information Act from like Canada. There was some kind of preclinical paper, technical paper. Preclinical meaning this was done in mice, right? Animals. And they were looking at the biodistribution of the mRNA vaccine or some.
It's a little more than that.
Okay. Can you explain what that was? And then we can talk about what it showed.
Yeah, I have to lapse into regulatory speak for a moment. I'm sorry. In drug development, you have to submit, when you want to go into humans, you have to submit a document to the regulators that summarizes everything you know about the product. And that includes how you manufacture it, how stable it is, the tests that you run to make sure that it, we call it identity, that it's exactly what it's supposed to do, that it's not contaminated, so purity. Non-clinical, that what that means is animal studies, basically, and other bench studies that assess the potential toxicity, biodistribution, other things. Any clinical data that's known, literature, basis or justification for use in humans, what are you tending to do? All that stuff goes into a package, a document, kind of a super report. And it has we've got to the point now where all the governments, pretty much of the world, all agree that if you do this with a certain form, then they'll all accept it. So you don't have to take the same data and change it, put it into Europeans, change it, put it into the Chinese, whatever. Okay. So we call that the common technical document. In the United States, we used to call it the initial new drug application. But now it's pretty much called the CTD as the acronym. So what Aaron's talking about is that a group of Canadians, one of them, Dr. Bridle, that's a different story, is being really attacked.
Hammered.
For doing this.
Hammered.
Yeah. They're trying to make him lose his funding and lose his job. He's got a family. He's a really nice guy. So a group of Canadians that were worried about the toxicity events, the signals that they were seeing, did a Freedom of Information Act to obtain the common technical document on the Pfizer product from the regulatory authorities in Japan. Now, why they chose Japan, I don't know. Normally, these CTDs, you cannot FOIA. You can't obtain them. They're confidential. But they got them out of Japan. And within a day, Trial Site News had them and asked me to review them. So that's the context that I'm talking about. And Trial Site News also asked me to review the public letter that the European Medicines Agency issued after reviewing presumably the same CTD, but it was in English, not in Japanese, presumably. And so this, I was given the summary letter from the European Medicines Agency and the Japanese common technical document that had been obtained. And most of that Japanese document is in Japanese, and I don't read Japanese, so there's that. But there's some data tables in there that are in English. And so what she's referring to is the non-clinical data tables that are in the CTD obtained from Japan for the Pfizer vaccine. That's the lower dose of the two mRNA vaccines. And it had some, in particular, two groups of data, all addressing the biodistribution. In addition, there was summaries of The toxicology in the non-confidential EMA document. So I reviewed these for Trial Site News, and then I was alarmed a bit by what I read. And so I had an even more senior regulatory affairs specialist read them see if he agreed that these looked alarming or concerning. And he did, and he pointed out some other things that I missed, such as that the reproductive toxicology studies had only been done partially, and there was no genotoxicity studies. Okay, so the details that Aaron's talking about involved studies designed to address where is the protein being expressed after injection using rodent models, and where is the RNA going after injection, and where is the lipid part? Now, we're getting into the weeds of how this stuff works. And I heard the metaphor the other day of a FedEx package. If you imagine a FedEx letter package, we all know that. The letter inside is the RNA, and the cardboard on the outside is lipids, it's fats. The package is designed to deliver the letter into a cell. And as it does that, the lipids, the fat part, the package falls off, and the RNA becomes available to be loaded onto the machinery that translates the RNA and makes protein. Okay, so that's the big picture. What was unusual was that these typically critical experiments were not done to the high standards that they usually are. So the regulatory language is they were non-good laboratory practices, as opposed to the usual required good laboratory practices. What does that mean? Non-GLP is kind of like what a graduate student might do in a professor's lab to ask a question about biodistribution. They don't have a bunch of protocols they have to follow. The machines don't have to all be calibrated. They don't have to keep good notes about everything. They can kind of say, this is the results. It looks like this. And that is usually not acceptable. The rule in this kind of world is if it's not written and documented, it didn't happen, because people make mistakes from time to time. So non-GLP, small number, rodent studies. I want to emphasize one of the things that means is that if we criticize those, we have to keep in mind they're not the final answer, those studies. And in fact, apparently, according to Peter Marks, when I spoke to him about this at the FDA, he's head of the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research. He said, hey, we've received a new, I'm paraphrasing. He said, we've received a new package from Pfizer that's updated. And Robert, just back off a little bit and give me the time to have my people review that package. And then we're going to make our determination on presumably licensure based on these new data. So the Japanese data, we have to keep in mind, was done to a standard that was not rigorous. And furthermore, they're outdated. They were probably the same data that was used to justify the emergency use authorization that is the basis for all receiving those vaccines. So there it is. It's not perfect data. But we can't then turn around and say, oh, but it shows these things. We have to kind of say, it might show these things, but it might not, because it wasn't done rigorously.
Well, right. And I think too, these are done in mice. That doesn't mean, like, it could be different, very different in humans.
Yeah. Those of us that have done mouse experiments often say, mice lie, monkeys mislead. And the only thing that really predicts response in humans is response in humans, is the general rule. Okay, so you're dead on. All kinds of caveats about these data. But what they show in this experiment is that they don't actually use the spike RNA. They use an RNA that codes for a luciferase, which is the thing that makes the firefly tail glow. And that's a really sensitive, we call it reporter gene. because we got good technology to detect photons. And they used that to detect where it went. And they used the least sensitive method, which is to look at the whole animal. So that means that wherever the luciferase goes in the whole animal, the photons have to go up through that tissue, through the bone and muscle, through the skin and hair, and hit the photomultiplier tube, which means that most of those photons bounce around, they never get out. Okay. And so what you get when you use that method, it's really cool. You get glowing mice, you know, like a firefly. But the signal you detect is where the majority of the expression is. You don't detect the areas where there's less expression. And so it's kind of a biased experiment. It is a biased experiment to only detecting the areas that have the highest level of expression. That's a little bit fishy because you're trying to ask the question, where in the body is this protein being expressed? And you would think you would want to use the method that would be most sensitive, but they didn't. Point number one. Point number two, there's a data table there that they radio labeled. So they put tritium, radioactive RNA, and that allows you to really sensitively detect where the RNA goes. And then they used an assay for this novel engineered fat that is what's used to slip the RNA, is the package in the FedEx metaphor. So we have looking for luciferase RNA expression, that says where we're getting expression. There's looking for the tritium on the RNA, that says where does the RNA go. And then there's the assay they use to detect the lipids. What has a lot of people concerned is in this imperfect small rodent experiment, one of the things that's striking, you know, you see the lipids and the RNA going to organs that you would expect it to go to, like liver and spleen. But the lipid part, strangely, in female rodents, collects at about 12% of the total injected in the ovaries, but not in the testes. That's kind of odd. It also goes to bone marrow and other sites. Now, the RNA, people get a little confused about this. The RNA signal is the right side of that table, and it's the radioactive RNA. And in ovaries, that only shows that less than 1% of the RNA goes there. So for some reason, the lipids are accumulating in the ovary, although the RNA isn't. Why is that? How is that happening? Unknown. Does it mean anything? Unknown. Because we didn't do reproductive tox experiments. And we don't really have any prior experience with this novel synthetic lipid. So we a lot of folks got pretty bent up and said, oh, this means that the stuff in the bone marrow is going to cause leukemia. And Steve said these things on the Weinstein podcast, and I couldn't get a word in edgewise with him. But these things were said, that you could have these bone marrow diseases and you could have horrible reproductive effects. And the truth is, I can't say that there won't be problems because I don't have the data. We don't have the data. Doesn't mean that they're absolutely going to happen either.
Right. And I think you cleared up something that a lot of people think, that's the lipids in these preclinical studies that were in the ovary, not the messenger RNA, which codes for the spike protein. So that means your ovarian cells were not expressing this spike protein.
Well, so there you said it. I can't say that they weren't.
Okay. Well, I can't either.
I was say that. Yeah, nobody can. Okay. That's the whole problem.
Okay.
Is that the studies weren't done well. And so we're left with all of these coulda, shoulda, woulda. Uh-oh, what's happening? And that's what's a little odd here, is normally all that stuff would have been cleared up. And for some reason, it wasn't, presumably because everybody was in a rush, because they wanted to save the world for good reason. And they were doing, you know, presumably the best of intentions. But to say to the public, no corners were cut, isn't really true. And that's where I start to have problems with all this, is I think that the government owes it to their populace to be open and transparent about what's true, what's known, and what's unknown. Because they're obligated to, and the pharmaceutical company is obligated to fully disclose all risks, because this is a fundamental precept of bioethics in human subject research. Full stop.
That's fair. That's why the whole field of bioethics exists, because it was abused in the past, right? So it's like the golden rule of research. I would agree with that. And I think what you're saying, being honest with people, and it's part of informed consent, and like no, saying what you know and what you don't know, part of informed consent, but that also doesn't mean it has to take away from the efficacy of the vaccines, or like the great benefit that we're seeing in terms of how they're working. And
completely
people
agree.
Yeah, both of those things can be true at the same time.
Yep.
And
thank you.
Yeah, and I think that's like, I think sometimes people will, they try to like reduce you to like one side, and you're just like trying to, you know, be scientific.
I'm a scientist.
Yeah.
I'm a scientist, right? I live in a world in which almost nothing is known. I mean, if you ask me, how much do you actually know about this? 9 times out of 10, I'm probably going to say, I don't really know the answer.
Yeah.
And I try hard to be honest. And that's the nature of science.
Right.
And it's the nature of scientific discussion, is then us scientists and physicians like yourself have this active dialogue where, and we use this term hypothesis instead of fact, where we're constantly kind of second guessing ourselves and each other, saying, are you sure this is really what's going on? And that's why we have to not be censored. We have to be able to talk about this. That's how we get to truth, or our version of truth.
So in terms of censorship, how would you handle misinformation, like blatant misinformation?
My thoughts 6 months ago were probably very different from what they are now, having been through what I've been through.
You've been censored. You've been censored a lot, which is tragic.
As have many of us.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree. I agree.
I think that this whole meme of me as the guy, you know, I'm not somebody who seeks attention. I don't blow my own horn generally. And my wife criticizes me for that, and wishes I would do more of that, but it's not my style. But now that it's come out that I played these key roles, it allows me to have legitimacy. And I think it may be partially protecting me from the censors that are out there. And I think I'm being able to say things I'm being able to post things and say things that other scientists post, might, you know, often posted before me, made the same observation and got deleted. So for some reason, I think it may be because I have this legitimacy now from this story, my personal origin story, that is keeping them from censoring me in the same way as they might. What do we do about the deliberate misinformation, such as the paid trolls that are out there? I think this is one of the toughest decisions and topics that we have to deal with as a society right now, because clearly our elections have been subjected to manipulation by these kinds of paid trolls. And I know enough from my work with various clients and interfacing the intelligence community, there are some really powerful tools that can be used to shape public opinion. And I think the Trusted News Initiative was intended to help circumvent that. But the rubber hits the road at the level we were talking about, just average middle-class folk that are trying to pay their mortgages, are where this gets operationalized. And they're not, Yale-trained MD PhDs. They're just folks trying to make a living, and they've got a list that they have to go through. And if they see ivermectin and COVID in the same paragraph, off it goes. And that's the rules that they're given, and they follow the rules. I think that's kind of what's happening. And I think that we may have to come. So you're more on the millennial side. I'm at the tail end of the boomers. Both of our generations, but particularly yours, has been subjected to amazingly refined tools for advertising. And you've grown up with it and learned how to manage that information and that manipulation and to be resistant to it and go on with your life. I think that we may be better suited to learn to adjust and tolerate to some of this disinformation and take personal responsibility for validating things ourselves. It's tough to do, but the loss of freedom to speak of this First Amendment thing, and that's part of, I think, is something that is really damaging and troubling. I think we're seeing it expressed now in this real world situation. But I can tell you that part of the reason why I'm getting hit by the conservative media all the time for talks is because they're really sensitive to these First Amendment issues. And that's part of what they're lighting up about. But I think with this disease and this situation, there is a ton of fear.
Yeah.
And absolutely. And knocking people out and deleting Facebook right. groups and things like that is a form of gaslighting. It's denying their fear and denying their anxiety. And that's really counterproductive. And I think kind of as physicians, you and me, we can both appreciate that that's just not good for their mental health.
No, I think it's terrible. That's why I always tried, even if I see, if someone writes something, that's the thing, you can always find the common ground with someone if they don't have an agenda to personally, if they aren't there to attack you, sabotage you, they're really probably there just looking for information, you know? Like, I have flight anxiety, and the things I say before I get on a plane are probably crazy. Like, I mean, I'm just like, you know, and I'm like analyzing the pilot as if I knew where he was, like, you know, let me see his eyes. Like, let me see her eyes. Like, it's just, it's really, but it's not, it's just a fear. It's a fear. And I think like somebody is around, they can talk me through that fear. And I'm like, okay, yeah. You know, they're not gonna be like, hey, just shut up and sit, you know, you don't count. Your views don't count. You're not scientific enough. When you have these platforms where like they pride themselves for the democratic sharing of information, well, guess what? That's going to be messy. Right? That's going to be messy.
Yeah.
So I think we have
But Aaron, I think that, so bridging from that to what we're doing right now, we're trying to provide understandable information that kind of disambiguates and clarifies a lot of these issues that people have anxieties about. And some on the web have criticized me for speaking slowly. It's me compensating for the fact that I natively often talk too fast, and also trying really hard to process inside of my own mind what I'm about to say so that it is understandable and less likely to be misunderstood. And I try really hard, as you hopefully just heard, to make complicated stuff easy to understand for folks that haven't had this stupid long period of postgraduate training that you and I have had to been through. Because there's a supposedly Feynman, Richard Feynman, Nobel laureate, the guy that figured out the Challenger disaster and a lot of other things, supposedly once said, if you can't say it simply, you don't really understand it. And I think there's merit to that. So I try to make it clear.